Good evening. This is Life Rattle, your story show, and I'm your host, Virginia Ashbery. Tonight, Life Rattle number 1379 features three short stories by three writers, Julie Merkovich, Natasha Wong, and Paul Goldwater. On this month's archive program, we're going to hear three writers who, at the time of recording, were all university undergraduates. Their stories tell about early work experiences as a sales clerk, a library page, and a border guard. Our first writer is Julie Merkovich. Merkovich was born in Toronto in 1979, the younger of two daughters. The family moved to Mississauga when Julie was less than a year old. She grew up and went to school there, including the University of Toronto at Mississauga, while she worked part-time. As we'll hear in a moment, Merkovich started working early. Let's listen now as Julie Merkovich reads her story, Who Hires 15-Year-Olds? And you're listening to Life Rattle from Toronto, and remember, Life Rattle stories often contain situations and language that some listeners may find offensive, but not so much on tonight's podcast.
Who Hires 15-Year-Olds by Julie Merkovich. I had just turned 15 at the beginning of October. At the dinner table, my dad told me he had a great idea. Why don't you get a job like your sister? Who, me? I whined. Irina got her first job at 17, and I was supposed to get a job at 15? This is so not fair. I didn't say anything to my dad. I just nodded. Hopefully he'd forget about his great idea. A week later, I got home from school. My dad greeted me at the door. I must be in trouble or something, I thought. Why would he greet me at the door? Dad handed me an application for Consumers Distributing. I was driving by, and the sign said that they were hiring, so I picked up an application for you. He didn't forget. Dad, who the heck hires 15-year-olds? I had no chance of getting this job. Why would they pick me over older, more mature people? I tried to stop my hand from reaching out for the application, but I took it. My dad has premature wrinkles from working 14 hours a day at two jobs, so I could not refuse. His limited English wouldn't help him understand that in Canada there was something called child labor laws, and he looked so excited about the idea of me getting a job. I didn't want to disappoint him. A week later, I got a phone call. I had an interview with Dan. My dad was driving me, and he let me out. I'll see you at home. Good luck, he said. Consumers Distributing was in an old strip mall on Dundas and Highway 10. In the back of the dark, grimy warehouse, I sat with five others, crowded in the lunchroom. Four of us sat squished together on the orange velvet couch. Nobody spoke. I was the youngest. An older black man sat directly in front of me in a wobbly wooden chair. To the right of him sat a curly-haired younger woman, her eyes wide open as she bit her lower lip. My foot tapped uncontrollably, and my palms sweated. I didn't want to be rude and stare at the other two men and younger lady that were sitting on the couch with me. I swear, the couch smelled like my grandmother's ancient couch in her basement, but 10 times worse. The boss finally came in. He gave us written math and comprehension tests. I surprised myself by finishing the test before anyone else. A week later came my first day of training for my new job at Consumers Distributing. I was going to be a jewelry consultant. I wondered if this place was for real. Who hires 15-year-olds and puts them in charge of the jewelry counter? I arrived at 3:30, half an hour early for my shift. I wore my new dress pants and blue blouse. 10 people stood around the counter waiting to be served. Susan, the jewelry manager, smiled at me as I approached. Her thin eyebrows spread up and apart. Her chin lifted, and she shrugged her shoulders, indicating that I would be waiting a while for her attention. I stood frozen by the jewelry cabinet and watched Susan scurry between two customers. I could feel the eyes of the impatient customers penetrating me. A woman standing in front of one of the glass cabinets gave me a little nod to come and help her. Sorry, I can't help you. I'm new, I said in the sweetest high-pitched voice. Susan was getting frustrated and took a deep breath in while clenching her teeth. Oh, just help them. Here's the key for the cabinets. You can do it. My eyes grew bigger. My sweaty hand reached out for the key. Who was next? Susan shouted. She pointed out the customer that I was supposed to help. I tripped on my shoelace as I walked over to the lady and was frightened to stop and tie it up. Hello, may I help you? The plump, red-faced lady took a deep breath in and breathed out of her nose. I felt like I was holding a red cloth and she was the raging bull. She spoke in a low tone with her lips tightly pushed together. I've been standing here for 20 minutes to get some service. You guys are lucky that I'm still here. Susan looked over from the corner of her eye. Heat took over my whole body. I could feel my face getting hotter and redder. I'm very sorry. I'm in training, so I'll do my best to help you out. Great, the lady slurred under her breath. Can you show me the I love you, Mom charm? I wondered if any love could possibly squeeze into this woman. I searched frantically among the hundreds of charms in the glass cabinet below me. My hands tried to force the key into the keyhole on the back of the cabinet. Could you possibly point out the charm for me? I mumbled, embarrassed. The lady's head leaned sideways and she smiled. It's right there, she said each word individually and clearly. Her long fingernail pointed it out. As I reached for the charm, the realization came over me that applying for a job at McDonald's didn't look so bad anymore.
That was Julie Merkovich reading her story, Who Hires 15-Year-Olds? As a postscript to that story, despite her early complaints about the job, Merkovich lasted 2 years at Consumers Distributing until the company went under in 1997. Merkovich said her job at Consumers helped pay for her first year university tuition. Our next writer is Natasha Wong. Born in 1978, the elder of two daughters in Toronto. Wong also grew up in Mississauga and, at the time of recording, was studying for a Bachelor of Science. Let's listen now as Natasha Wong reads her story titled Jane.
Jane by Natasha Wong. Last Tuesday, Jane died. In the 4 days leading up to her funeral, I learned more about Jane than I ever knew when she was alive. I never knew that she collected teddy bears and was only 52 years old. I never knew that she had a brother and a sister. I never knew she was Catholic and went to church every Sunday. I never even knew she wasn't married. Jane Crawford was the manager of the children's department of the library, where I work as a page putting away books. Jane looked in her early 60s with gray-white hair and round gold-rimmed glasses framing her face. She always wore slacks, a white shirt with a sweater over it, and white running shoes. Jane had a very stern and serious manner. The pages had little personal contact with Jane. If you said hello, sometimes she responded, but then went back to what she had been doing. Sometimes the managers from other departments came down to the children's department to say hi to Jane. She talked amicably with them, standing off in a corner of the library. When the pages talked in the back room, she gave us this look, where her eyebrows lowered and her eyes bore down on us. We stopped talking. We tried to distract Jane by making inane conversation. One time, she came into work early. "Hey, Jane, how are you?" I said nervously. "I'm fine. I hope you're working hard, Natasha. I want to see all these book trucks gone tomorrow." She looked straight at me, her mouth pursed in disapproving lines. She used a higher tone voice, usually reserved for babies, enunciating every syllable as if English was a foreign language to me. She sounded serious and joking at the same time. I couldn't tell. "I'll try," I said. "It's been real busy here today. I think I'd like to run away and play hooky," said Jane. I suppressed the urge to roll my eyes. I said nothing, just nodded. She left and I relaxed my tense muscles. One time, she came back from a meeting and wanted me to help her carry some things to her car. She looked rushed, with her glasses askew on her face and her hair mussed. I got my coat, grabbed a cardboard box, and headed toward the underground parking lot. I had to keep shifting the weight around. Jane shot me an impatient look. "Do you know where we're taking these boxes, Natasha?" she asked in her baby voice. "To your car?" We passed the elevator. "Aren't we going up the elevator?" I asked. "We're going to the underground parking lot. Do you know how to get to the parking lot from here, Natasha?" "Yes, but I thought we were going the other way." "You have to use your noodle, Natasha," she said, knocking on my head as if it were a door she expected to open. I said nothing. Every year, the pages got evaluations. Jane talked to us about the observations that the senior staff had made. Every year, she said the same thing to everyone. "Your work is satisfactory, but you talk too often. Please try to chat less. If someone speaks to you, tell them not to talk to you." Jane talks just as much. Even one of the senior staff members, Leslie, once mentioned how she couldn't get Jane to shut up. She just kept talking. Then, when she was leaving, I mentioned that I hoped that she would be able to make it to work the next day after the snowstorm. That was a mistake. She came back and started talking again. "When will I learn?" Everyone in the children's department attended her funeral. Many of the senior staff cried as the service ended. The pages sat quietly in the pew with solemn faces. Afterward, we skipped the wake and went to Burger King instead.
That was Natasha Wong reading her story titled Jane. Paul Goldwater is a pseudonym for the final writer on this program. Goldwater was born in London, England, the oldest of four boys. The family emigrated from London, England, to St. Catharines, Ontario, in 1988 when Paul was 9 years old. Goldwater grew up and went to school in St. Catharines, then went on to study biology, anthropology, and French at U of T in Mississauga. Like the previous writer on tonight's program, Natasha Wong, Goldwater continued to work part-time at the job in this story while he attended school. Let's listen now as Paul Goldwater reads his story, Border Patrol, on Life Rattle.
Border Patrol. 1 month after my second year of university ended, I was sworn in as a federal law enforcement officer. My freshly polished government-issue boots still squeaked when I walked. My recently dry-cleaned navy blue pants felt tight, stiff, and uncomfortable. My dry-cleaned and even stiffer blue-collar shirt tucked inside my two-week-old pant belt with a golden buckle. Finally, a large utility belt, black, shiny, and thick, clipped over my pant belt, ready to hold handcuffs, a flashlight, and other Border Patrol toys. After 2 weeks of training, I felt ready for the border. I proudly held up my right hand and took the oath. Then I was given my golden badge, my shield to uphold justice. The shield had inscribed Border Patrol and my badge number, 22993. It was official. I now had powers of arrest and detainment. I had the knowledge and ability to prevent criminals and smugglers from entering the country. My first night, I arrived at headquarters in my clean and pressed uniform. I entered the building through a rear door. Using my 6-digit entry code to unlock it, I walked down a narrow hallway towards the office area, passing the cells used to lock up the not-so-innocent. All the cells were vacant. I walked past a room full of TV screens. Each screen displayed a different image. Most show different areas of the bridge and the people who crossed it. The bridge itself, one of the busiest in the country, stood continually lined with cars full of tourists and beach bums. The impatient chain stretched out of sight. Two officers stared at the screens while they drank their coffees. At least 20 other officers walked around in the office area. From behind, a tall, much larger officer, wearing the same uniform as I did, placed his hand on my shoulder. "Hey, rookie, I'm Tom. What's yours?" he said. "Paul," I replied with a deeper voice than my usual. Tom was in his late 20s, in good shape and enthusiastic about meeting me. "Well, Paul, tonight we're working together. We won't throw you to the wolves just yet." I laughed. Tom seemed like a nice guy. "Let's go outside, Paul, and get started, all right?" I nodded. Tom snapped on a bulletproof vest. I didn't have one. My heart beat faster. I spent the next 3 hours searching ashtrays, glove compartments, wallets, purses, trunks, seats, and pockets. My clean blue shirt and navy pants quickly became covered in grease and dirt. I did all the hard labor while Tom interrogated the travelers. "Where are you going tonight?" he asked each traveler. "Do you smoke dope?" he asked two kids who pulled up in an old Mustang. "Do you have a firearm in the back of your truck?" he asked a bearded man from Texas. Tom let each of these cars go after we were satisfied that the occupants were telling the truth. As midnight approached, the number of officers on duty had lessened. Tom, another officer named Sammy, and I performed vehicle searches in the outdoor examination area. I noticed Sammy liked to flirt with the women. An officer in his late 30s, you could smell his cologne from three cars down. He leaned on a red convertible and attempted conversation with a brunette. "So what will you do for me if I let you into the country tonight?" Sammy asked her. "I'll pay the toll," the girl said with a smile. Tom approached me from behind again. "Paul, don't pay any attention to Sammy. He's been here for 20 years. Sometimes you develop some bad habits." A white Honda Civic pulled up within 2 feet from Tom and me. A tall young man got out of the car. His dark brown hair was greased back behind his ears. He had thick eyebrows. He hadn't shaven for days. He looked nervous. He handed me a ticket, which he'd received from the officer who told him to pull over. The ticket indicated that the officer suspected drugs in the vehicle. The message was coded and could only be deciphered by Border Patrol officers. "Officer, I'm not sure why you pulled me over," said the tall, scruffy, and confused driver. I read the ticket. "Please step in front of your vehicle while I look through your car." The young man stepped up onto the curb in front of the vehicle. He lit a cigarette. I searched the entire car. I sweated. Tom rummaged through the trunk. I stared at the driver. One hand fumbled through a pocket. The other hand scratched his unshaven neck. He avoided my stare. He concealed something. "Sir, dump your pockets onto the hood," I instructed the driver. "Give me a break," he yelled back at me. "Sir, you can do it now, or we can strip you inside and look through them ourselves." The driver slipped his hand into his pocket. He pulled out a lighter, keys, and a small plastic sandwich bag. He perspired as much as I did. Tom stood at my side. My hands shook. My heart pumped even faster. Tom smelled the contents of the bag. He nodded. "Son, you're in quite a bit of trouble," Tom said. I grabbed the driver's wrist, placed his arm behind his back, and guided him so he faced the brick wall. "Place both hands against the wall above your head," I requested. "I am going to frisk you. Do you have any sharp objects on you?" "No, officer," the young man replied as he bowed his head to focus on the ground. I frisked him and found nothing but a wallet and a pack of cigarettes. Tom handcuffed him while I read him his rights. "I am arresting you for attempting to smuggle goods, the importation of which is prohibited. Do you understand what is being said to you?" The handcuffed driver nodded. Tom and I led him to a vacant cell.
That was Paul Goldwater reading his story, Border Patrol. And that concludes Life Rattle number 1379. Arnie Ackman recorded Paul Goldwater, Natasha Wong, and Julie Merkovich reading their stories. My name is Virginia Ashbury. Life Rattle is produced from Toronto, Ontario, and was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Ackman.